Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet one of the members of the Tulsa Artists Fellowship. Started 2 years ago by the George Kaiser Family Foundation, the fellowship provides support for mid-career visual artists and, as of this year, literary artists as well. The idea is to inspire and inject creative culture into our community. The TAF will feature three literary members in an upcoming writer's salon next week. My guest today is one of those featured writers, Anna Botkin. Botkin was born in the Soviet Union and now lives in the United States, but has spent much of her writing life in the global South, reporting and writing about the people and communities affected by war, poverty, and conflict. She's the author of six works of nonfiction. Her most recent, Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah, reported on her time spent with the Fulani, a traditional cattleman culture in West Africa. Prior to that, The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village, followed a small northern Afghani community as they battle extreme poverty and violence in equal measure. Her journalism has appeared in the New York Times, New Republic, and Foreign Policy, and she's using her fellowship to support the writing of her first novel. She'll join two other fellow members, Melanie Gilman and Simon Hahn, at the TAF Writer Salon, which is coming up a week from tomorrow, Wednesday, September 6th at 7 o'clock at Central Library. She joins me as my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Anna Botkin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
When people come to the Writer Salon and hear you talk about your work, what's really evident is you're looking at people around the world in which they live a very different life than modern 21st century life. In many ways, their way of life is, if not endangered, threatened, I would say. What attracts you to these stories about people who are living life that has probably hadn't changed in hundreds of years in many ways?
I'm going to put your question a little bit on its head. The people with whom I work do live a modern 21st century life. About a quarter of the population of the world lives below poverty level, and the people I work with are among that quarter of the world. So they live in the 21st century just like you live in the 21st century, as our audience lives in the 21st century. Therefore, I would argue that they're very, very modern. I grew up in the global South in a way, though mine was at 60th parallel north. I grew up in Leningrad, USSR, in a country that doesn't exist, in a city that doesn't exist anymore. And so I am less of a stranger, maybe, to the lifestyles that I encounter. But what really I think the purpose of my work is, and has been for the more than 20 years that I've been doing this, is to hold the world accountable a little bit through storytelling, to examine a different way of looking at the world. Because while I may have my own personal history in the global South, my audience is mostly modern, you know, contemporary,
urban
right?
Global North.
Global North, correct. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little bit of a translator from one world I know to another world I know, which share the world. So that's what I think the task is. And there was a wonderful Polish poet named Zbigniew Herbert, and he had one poem in which there were these lines: "You were saved not in order to live. You have little time. You must give testimony." So this is what I do, or try to do.
Would you say your last two books have focused on people in the far north of Afghanistan in utter poverty, in which, you know, a year's work goes into making a rug that sells for $200? You followed a group of Malian cattle herders, the Fulani.
Cowboys.
Yeah, cowboys. They really are cowboys. They're the largest group of nomadic people left in the world. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, what I took from The World is a Carpet, from that small village of, I believe it's Oka.
Correct.
They actually prefer living there as opposed to a big city.
Well,
or giving up that. Obviously, the poverty is extreme, and you write about all the things that go with that poverty. But they could move to a city and try to make a way in the city, and yet they still live there.
Well, like a few things. One is that what I'm trying to convey in my storytelling is that actually, no, they couldn't move to the city.
Okay.
You and I could move someplace because we have assets. Even if we, by U.S. standards, live below poverty level, we still have assets.
Right.
I'm talking, writing about people who have, whose assets are the soil they work on, the rug they work on. So if you take that away, what are they going to do? They don't have a place to be in the city. They don't have savings that could put them in a, you know, in a rental space in a city. So that's, that really is not an option. However, you know, there is global migration toward urban centers, and demographics experts predict that in 100 years we all will be settled and living in cities. So eventually I think the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of my friends will be urban. But what I try to do in this work is I try to tell you, hey, imagine what this is like to be living in Oka or to be herding cattle on foot. Imagine how you perceive the world if you have been always walking it at the pace of 3 miles an hour for the last 10,000 years, because that's where the Fulani come from. They come from the original domesticators, or at least one chunk of the original domesticators of cow, the people who domesticated cow in Africa, and they have always been walking. What is it like to perceive the world from that speed and from that distance? And also, I'm very curious about deep history, geological history, but also deep human history. And so, you know, we evolved to experience the world at the pace of 3 miles an hour in an open, relatively flat space. So this is what my Fulani friends are doing. They are experiencing the world like that. What does it do to your perception of loss? What does it do to your perception of love? What does it do to your affections? What does it do to your grief? How do you wrap yourself around being in the world if this is how you do it?
Did you find there were differences?
Yes, I found that my hosts, my friends in the bush in Mali, have a much more Buddhist-like outlook on life because they have to constantly leave someone or something behind. So they're always departing, but they're also always arriving. So there is this appreciation of temporariness of everything. Everything will pass, and we just have to let go. So, you know, it was really a lesson for me in letting go and holding on.
I was struck by one of the Fulani women who they were talking about the children that lived and the children that died. And as they are nomadic, they camp at the grave sites of some of the children that have died.
Right.
And there's that sort of connection that they come back to that every year as right. they make their migration.
Right. And, you know, if you think about it, actually, every campsite is a gravesite because children die cyclically, you know.
Elders die. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mali has one of the highest rate of child infant death in the world. And Fulani, because of their lifestyle and the inaccessibility of health care, have an even higher rate than an average Malian. So probably more than half of all your children are going to die. But because you're probably traveling around the same area, your cycle, your annual cycle of migration repeats itself most of the years. So most of the years you will be passing by or stopping at the place where you have left your loved ones.
Do the Fulani, when they migrate, are they migrating within Mali or are they crossing borders? Is this a transnational issue with their nomadic lifestyle?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. Fulani are older than borders,
yeah,
which
right.
were, of course, drawn in Europe by
white
people.
People.
Absolutely. So, yes, traditional migrating routes, no borders. But we're running into other issues here. For example, the extremist wars that are ravaging sub-Saharan Africa today are changing the routes of migration. They're affecting the routes of migration. Also, Fulani in some countries are joining these wars as combatants Boko Haram in Nigeria and Cameroon rely pretty heavily on Fulani people. So they're on both sides of the conflicts, and they're also affected by these conflicts. Cattle is expensive, and cattle is great asset. So if you're driving a herd of, 200 head of cattle, and I want some money, this is what I'm going to kidnap. I'm going to take your cattle and sell it someplace. So Fulani do fall prey to gunmen who are just looking for extra cash.
And I was struck by something you said pretty early in the book, which was that in many cases they are envied because they're considered rich because they have this asset of cattle compared to the average Malian.
That's right. This is where we run into very different ways of looking at the world. Fulani traditionally believe that God created all of the world for the cow. Fulani don't say, I herd cattle. They say, I follow cattle. They do not look at cattle as monetary wealth. They definitely do look at cattle as wealth. But the monetary wealth, well, actually, Fulani, purely nomadic Fulani, like my hosts, and a lot of Fulani are settled, and a lot of Fulani are taxi drivers and doctors in New York,
right.
And a lot of Fulani are presidents of African countries. So we're talking here about
a large tribe, a tribal ethnic group.
Right, but what the book talks about, a very specific family of nomads. So the nomadic Fulani don't use money. They barter. They live in a pre-monetary economy. So they don't see their cattle as cash. They don't see their cattle with dollar signs. But people who are urban or urbanized, they see cattle and they know how much it costs. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's a very different viewpoint and way of looking at what wealth is. So, yes, Fulani who have cattle, if they were to sell it, could be very rich. But a Fulani without cattle, they'd say it's not a Fulani. So.
And you followed them around for what, about a year?
Right. I herded cattle with this one nomadic Fulani family on and off for a year.
During that year you were with them, what were the big issues? Were they facing extremist groups that were coming within their midst, rustlers? Going back to the Old West, what were the biggest challenges to life that year? I guess it was a drought year, correct?
Every year in Africa has been a drought year in the recent 20, 30 years. The cyclical droughts that always
There's a dry season and a wet season, but the wet season hasn't been coming.
Correct. But there also have been devastating cyclical droughts. And you probably, and a lot of our audience probably remembers images from the 70s and the 80s where people were spooning their relatives into mass graves by the roadside. So that happens every 20 or 40 years or so. But for the last couple of decades, the drought has stopped being cyclical. It became continuous. Africa has been in a state of drought. That part of Africa, Northwest Africa, has been in a state of continual drought. So, and that is because of climate change. Add to that desertification by cattle, because cattle eat grass and
they eat it right down to the nub.
Absolutely.
Too.
Yeah. And so that means that there is less fodder. Add to that the war in northern Mali, where extremists are pushing down. Actually, it's spilling now into the traditional pasturage of my hosts. So yes, they had to curtail their routes, but definitely the worst scrouge was the fact that water and grass were too far apart. That's not good for the cow.
My guest today is Anna Botkin. She is a Tulsa Artist Fellowship writer, author of 6 works of nonfiction, most recently Walking with Abel, which was her story with the Fulani in Mali. She's author of a forthcoming book, Fisherman's Blue, set with Senegal fishermen. And prior to that, The World is a Carpet, which followed I guess this is a group you've gone back to on and off over the years in Afghanistan, but that was the most recent book, and it followed a year of an Afghani family, extreme poverty, basically, and followed the construction of a runner carpet, which was sort of the year's output of that family. And she'll be one of 3 writers participating in the Tulsa Artist Fellowship's Writers Salon, which will take place Wednesday, September 6th at Central Library, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, your Fulani had something in common with your Afghani family, which was drought. The area where in Oka, in far northern Afghanistan, had been suffering from a huge drought during the time you were there that had been going on for several years. Because if you're not making carpets in that area, I guess one of the only other ways to make money there is to gather basically brushwood and sell it.
Well, in fact, the family, the village, which was about 40 homes in Oka in northern Afghanistan, originally was settled by shepherds who would graze their sheep. And when my host told me that their grandfathers would graze their sheep, my reaction was, what do you mean graze? Because there was literally nothing to graze on. There was nothing. There was no fodder. So I guess in a very slow way, I am documenting the effect of climate change on the global south, because it's the global south that bears the brunt of our greed and our lackluster attitude toward our planet. Yes, the drought in Afghanistan, the drought in Mali, the book that comes out in March, Fisherman's Blues, is set on the ocean. So drought figures into the story, but not so much. But again, you know, it's about depletion of resources.
Overconsumption.
Overconsumption, absolutely. That is driven by our desire to eat more fish, because fish is good for you. So in a way, we're talking about how we, in our myopia, affect real people now, in real time, who are very far away. So maybe this is how I'm trying to bring us to some sort of responsibility.
As I was reading your book about the people of Oka, and at the same time the United States is announcing its latest policy in Afghanistan, there was this discordant note of all this fighting over this place in which, if you could go through the village of Oka, this is a town with dwellings. I say dwellings.
Correct.
I wouldn't call them homes necessarily by Western standards. I mean, they're homes, but they may or may not have complete roofs.
Right. They're mud brick homes.
Mud brick homes with open doorways, open windows. During the winter, you block in the windows
with
and the doors.
Mud.
And when it gets too warm in there, somebody just kicks out the window.
That's right.
That was amazing.
That's right. The houses look a little bit like rectangular soft pillows, because they have been so weather-worn and so handmade. The reason I wanted to write that book very much was because I had by then been working in Afghanistan for a decade. And what rubbed me very much the wrong way is how in Western literature, in modern Western literature, and I'm not just talking about journalism, I'm talking about books for the last, 100 years or so, 80 years. Afghanistan is depicted as a country that is suffering from a crisis, a current crisis. You know, we're talking about the Soviet invasion of the 1970s. We're talking about the American, U.S.-led invasion, right? That is now in its 16th
year. You could go back
another
150 years to the Raj, too.
Well, right. But the thing is that if you go back to the beginning of recorded history, you realize that Afghanistan has not been a country at peace. It has been invaded throughout the last 2,300 years constantly.
Persians, Genghis Khan.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Alexander the Great.
Yeah. So Persians, Alexander the Great, then, Chinese Buddhists came. I mean, it's an unfortunate geography in a way that is blessed with absolutely stunning beauty and so many resources, theoretically, right? And et cetera, et cetera. But what I wanted to show was what Afghanistan looks like for Afghans, not for Westerners, but not look at the country through, the window of an armored Humvee, which is how even more Americans are going to experience it now that it looks like we're sending more troops, but out of a window that you kick in of a mud hut, which is how most Afghans do live. Oka is maybe on the extreme, but it is not the extreme. Oka is very much an Afghan village. It's not the one Afghan village that is the poorest of all. No, Afghanistan is full of villages like that that have no sanitation, no access to health care, no access to clean water, sometimes no access to water, and very, very little money.
It is also a place, when you look for it on Google Earth, you can't find
there.
It. Can't see it.
Right.
Yeah. But I love the book, and the writing in it is so wonderful. And it's obvious the writing in your nonfiction is, as a Tulsa Artist Fellowship member, you're looking at writing your first novel. The language of your nonfiction is just lyrical language that's a part of it. But the title of the book comes from this great little quote that sort of defines a lot of these groups you're following. The world is a carpet. Tell us what the world is a carpet is for that family in Oka.
Well, we were talking about where I came from. And somebody said, where's she from? And somebody else said, America. You know, I didn't get a chance to speak because I'm a woman. and it was men who were talking. And they said, well, where is America? Oh, it's on the other side of the ocean. Well, what's an ocean? Well, it's like a big river. So men started pondering geography. And they asked me, you know, how far away is America? And I explained that it was very far away. And they marveled at the notion that all the American planes they see overhead are coming from that far away. And then they asked me which direction, if they took their donkey, which direction they should go to reach America. And I said, well, you could actually go east or west because the world is round. And that stirred some controversy in the conversation. And I started demonstrating with my hands how the world is round like a ball. And so you can go in either direction. It would be a very, very long journey. And the river that's the ocean is going to be very hard to ford on a donkey. But then the commander of the village is like, I'm not sure exactly what he was, except I'm pretty certain that he was the main drug dealer and he commanded the most respect and everybody called him the commander. So the elder, who was not the oldest man, but the most powerful man in the village, said, no, Pakistan is on this side, Iran is on that side, Tajikistan is over there, the world is rectangular. And I thought, well, the world is a carpet. Mm. There it is. So here we are in this village that makes carpets. And of course, how best to describe the world? But in fact, we are all threads in one another's carpet in this world. And however isolationist we become and however much we forget that we're all connected, we are all connected. What you and I do here in the United States, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, will affect my friends in Mali, my friends in Senegal, my friends in Afghanistan, my hosts in Iraq. We may choose not to know, but hopefully by creating art about the effects of our negligence, I'm turning it into a choice rather than a lack of option. So we can also choose to know and be more responsible toward one another.
You actually describe the work that you've done in these various locales around the world as documenting populations in extremis.
That's right.
Getting back to that original question, which you flipped, they may be in extremis. Are they in danger of surviving?
I'm going to take issue with the word they.
Okay.
Because I think that that's a very dangerous word. Once we other the other.
Us and them. Okay.
Right.
I understand.
So we as a species are extremely industrious. And I think that we are extremely geared to survival.
Yeah. Very adaptable.
So very adaptable. So what the question would probably be is this particular lifestyle going to survive modernization? Is this particular lifestyle going to survive climate change? Is this particular lifestyle going to survive globalized economy? The answer is absolutely not. Why would it? Why should it? Is that bad? Well, this is what I ask my audience very often. Do you like flush toilets? Because I do. And I'm pretty certain that my hosts in Oka and my hosts in Mali
would adapt very quickly to it.
Very much appreciate having flush toilets. They would very much appreciate not having to, you know, an average Fulani woman spends about 8 hours a day pounding millet into flour. That's backbreaking work, and it takes a lot of time. And when they asked me, you know, mockingly, hey, Anna, do you do this at home? And I said, no, I go to the store and I buy flour. And they say, but, you know, but if you don't have flour, I said, well, then I guess I'll put it in my blender. See, and in the meantime, I could use these 8 hours to do something else. I imagine that it would be wonderful for my friends, whom I love very deeply, to have access to modern medicine.
You mentioned those women. Yeah, modern medicine.
Absolutely.
You mentioned the women. When they're not pounding out millet, they're carrying water.
Carrying water. And, they're carrying firewood.
And I was really taken by your description of, you know, they walk really fast because, you know, it's like compression issues.
Right, because you carry your water on your head.
Yeah, right.
And you carry, you know, 4 or 5 gallons of water on your head. And that's I've done it. It's very difficult. There are compression issues. It's hard. It's painful. Yeah. And you do that several times a day. So here's the thing, you know, are people in the bush in Mali created for our exotic pleasure? My answer would be no. Some of my audience may disagree, but I'd say that my dear friends are not put on this earth to titillate our Orientalist fantasies. So, yes, something will be lost. Songs will be lost. A culture will be lost. A knowledge will be lost. And that is the way the world works. And it's not great, but it's not devastating.
But would it be better if they had modern medicine in their village, if they had clean water, if they had something besides gathering wood to make money,
which is, I think, why I take issue with the word they, with the pronoun they, because when we talk about them, then we can abstract, we can sort of abstract, you know, oh, you know, somebody will be, you know, not making these beautiful carpets anymore or not pounding this millet so beautifully and rhythmically anymore. But when we talk about us, when we take people close into our hearts and they become our friends, even when, you know, like when you read a book, the people you're traveling with, your fellow travelers for the duration of that book become your people. Do you want them to continue dying at the rate of, you know, 6 children out of 10? No. Why would you even ask that question?
Right. Well, it's wonderful work. The most recent book, Walking with Abel, Fisherman's Blues, coming out in March. Anna, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Writer and freelance journalist Anna Botkin speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's a member of the Tulsa Artists Fellowship and the author of 6 works of nonfiction. Her most recent is titled Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. It's published by Riverhead Books. She'll be one of 3 writers participating in the TFA Writer Salon, which will take place 1 week from tomorrow, Wednesday, September 6th at 7 o'clock at Central Library. For more information, visit tulsalibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.